Insights, solutions, and networking all come together at RSA Conference. Join a global cybersecurity community at rsaconference.com/ITSPMAG24.
Welcome to the ITSP Magazine Podcast Network, a modern, innovative multimedia platform, broadcasting ideas and connecting minds. Every company has a story to tell, from the small startup to the large enterprise, and everything in between. This is one of them. We hope you enjoy this brand story conversation.
Marco.
Sean.
Have you looked over your shoulder lately?
It's like somebody's watching me. Is that that song? I remember.
Somebody is watching you. I don't know. Who's in your house there? Are they even in your house?
I've been told that it's a safe environment, so I'm going to go
there
with
you go.
Trust. Perfect. Trust, but not verify. Wait, that's wrong. That's not what we should say. Trust and verify. That's more like it.
There you go. Now, I think the point I want to make before we get into this is that it's cybersecurity is so complex that we tend to take different stances and different views on where we should invest our time and money and team. And it's easy to put a lot of that effort onto the big things like servers and where a lot of transactions take place within the organization. We sometimes miss the point that there are other vectors that we might not realize are exposing us and our customers to risk. And we're going to talk a bit about that today. And I'm thrilled to that with our good friends at Imperva, Lynn Marks. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me.
This is going to be fun. You get to do probably my favorite job ever. Even more than what I'm doing now, which is build products. I love to build stuff, and there's a lot to it. Maybe we'll get a chance to touch on that in more depth as we talk about the challenges that a lot of organizations face. But first, kind of a quick view into some of the things you've done that led you to your current role at Imperva, and then what that role is that you're doing there.
Sure. Yeah. Hello, everyone. My name is Lynn Marks. I've been working in the product management space for around 10 years. And for the last seven or so years, I've been very lucky to work in cybersecurity, starting out by focusing on the bot management space, which is always very fun and complex. And now at Imperva, I get to work both on bot management and as well as protecting organizations from client-side attacks.
All right, so here comes the guy that knows less than everybody about this. So I'm gonna go ahead with the question, which is very honest, and it's kind of hard to grasp unless you are into it deep, as you are, and of course Sean knows way more than me. But what is this client side protection? How would you define it to someone that maybe is more on the business side and has to fork the budget to protect that particular kind of security attack and field, and I really need to know where am I putting my money and why.
Definitely. So when you're building out applications, you're generally thinking about two large domains. There's the server side, and then there's the client side. I think for many years now, organizations have already put a lot of investment and security investment in protecting their server side, because they understand that that's where the data is being stored. That's where all the logic is being kept. And they understand fairly well that attackers have been trying to compromise the server side and that they need to fork over the money, like you said, to protect it. Now, because so much protection has been put over on the server side, it means that attackers, which we know they like to go after the point of least resistance, they have been putting a lot more efforts into attacking the client side. When you're thinking about, let's say, an application, let's say the website, the client side is really what the end users are actually interacting with. So it's all of the UI that they're actually interacting with in order to be able to complete the goals that they're trying to do on your website. The client side is made up of HTML, CSS, JavaScript, and a lot of other resources. And it's those resources that you need to ensure that you're protecting from attacks so that your application and the data, the sensitive data that's in there, is not only secure from server-side theft, but also from client-side data theft as well.
Very good. And we're going to take a pause. I wanted to let you finish because obviously Sean has been attacked by something. All right, Sean, good to see you.
I'm back.
Something happened on client side, I guess, as I was learning what was going on, and I let Lee finish because I didn't want to interrupt it, because for the first time I actually got what client side means in cybersecurity, and now you're back. So
I've had a client side. Absolutely. But that's what I was hoping you could maybe take another moment and explain the client, because some folks might think client equals endpoint, which includes a whole stack of things. Can you kind of describe the attack surface, the exposure that you're specifically talking about? Where in that endpoint stack is the client side exposure?
Definitely. So in the client side vulnerabilities, there are many different types of attacks that can occur for the different types of frameworks that are being used. Or like I mentioned, there's the HTML, the CSS, the JavaScript. Specifically, what we're focusing on is protecting customers from attacks on the JavaScript. We know that JavaScript is actually the largest component, you can think of it. It makes up the largest amount of resources on the client side. And 98% of modern websites use JavaScript. I don't know what are those 2% that are not using them. with so much JavaScript being used, and that is both first-party JavaScript, so JavaScript that the organizations are developing themselves, which is coming directly from their origin, as well as third-party JavaScript, so JavaScript that they are using from third-party organizations to bring additional value on their website without actually having to spend the time and money developing it themselves. All of those are able to be hijacked and become compromised through Magecart attacks. That's specifically what we're protecting from. So Magecart attack is often the term that's used in the media when there's an attack occurring. You might have also heard the term form jacking, though, used. And form jacking, they tried to make the name very obvious, taking form and hijacking. Pretty much what happens is they are hijacking the information that an end user is entering into a form on the client side. So let's say you are on a bank website, you're entering in your login information, and as you are entering in your credentials into the form, the data is not only being sent to the correct server, the correct database, and authenticating you, but it's also being sent to the attacker's database as well. So what they've done in that instance is they have hijacked some of the JavaScript on the login page. It can either be first-party JavaScript or the third-party JavaScript, and they are able to skim the end user's sensitive data one record at a time. And that's really where the difference is between this and the server-side, like database attacks, where oftentimes, they might be able to break the defenses on the server, be able to steal a bunch of data, and then they get out, trying to remove any traces. And with the client-side attacks and form jacking, it's really a like under the radar, extremely slow, like one record at a time attack. And the really frustrating thing about this attack for organizations is because the applications continue to work as intended, it's extremely difficult for both the end users, but also the security practitioners that are protecting these applications to notice that anything is wrong on the client side. And that's why you end up seeing attacks that last for months, or some have even lasted for more than a year, where then afterwards they realize that malicious JavaScript had been injected and it's been stealing over time a lot of sensitive customer data that they then have to deal with all the negative repercussions that happen after they have a data leak.
So instead of stealing everything at one time, so you see it's missing, it's just like a little grape from from the fruit, and you don't realize that. Okay.
Exactly.
Has this been changing in the last few years, like technology allowing new things, or because it's using JavaScript, it's kind of still, I mean, how is technology changing in this and making things harder or better for the cybersecurity team?
Yeah, so this attack really is quite a new attack, because in the modernization processes that a lot of security teams and application teams have been making, they've been putting a lot more of the logic into the client side, and using also a lot more different types of third-party JavaScript. Let's say that's being added by the application team, it's being added by the marketing team to add a lot of additional value, right? You could think of Google Analytics or different payment things that they might want to add in there. So really what we've seen is that that's why this attack is becoming so much more prevalent now. JavaScript is continuing to be used more. We really don't see that this attack is going to wane. We really believe that every organization needs to start putting some kind of protection in place, and ensure that they're securing their client side, because you know the client side is continuing to become more diverse and more complex, and they need to continue to watch out for those attackers.
And speaking of watching out, how would an organization know that they are compromised already? So what indicators exist or not? How do they obfuscate those if they don't exist? And what should they be looking for if those indicators aren't there yet?
That is a great question. So the problem that we've seen is that the majority of organizations actually have a blind spot to the client side. So the security practitioners don't know what is the makeup of the client side supposed to be, right? They don't know what JavaScript or other resources are supposed to be there. So even if they do get an inventory created, they don't know, was it supposed to be added there or not? They don't know which of the JavaScript is, let's say, first party or third party. And especially for the third party JavaScript, because they're not actually controlling the code, it's difficult or almost impossible for them to actually know if that third-party JavaScript has been compromised. So really the first things that organizations need to do is to get the visibility in place. You want to have a solution in place that's going to not only give you like the initial snapshot of what are the resources and the JavaScript that's living on your client side, but also ensure that you have a system in place that's going to continue to monitor the makeup of the client side so that if anything new does get added or anything, let's say that is there on purpose, ends up being compromised, you have that visibility, you have that alerting, and you can go and quickly go and remove that JavaScript or remediate it in whatever other way your organization seems fit. So that's what I would say is really the first thing that most organizations need to do, especially with the fact that we've seen some statistics that less than 20% of security decision makers say that they have a good understanding of the makeup of the third-party JavaScript on their site. So, if less than 20% know, then that means that really the large majority of organizations, unfortunately, do currently have this gap that they need to overcome.
And are you seeing any figures in terms of activity? So 20% don't, or do have a view, 80% don't have a view. Does that translate into a large number of attacks that are underway, record at a time?
Yeah. So, and one of the difficult things is in the public space, we really only know if an attack is occurring if, let's say, you get publicized in the news, which organizations typically don't like to publicize if they have an attack like this. Or let's say if I'm an individual, I live in a country or a state where I'm required to be informed if my data is being leaked. So I would say, like, overall, we've definitely seen that the prevalence of these attacks are becoming higher and higher, with stolen records being anywhere from, you know, tens of thousands all the way to hundreds of thousands or millions. So the attacks are definitely becoming more prevalent. And I would say that they're definitely going to continue to become more prevalent. And it's going to have even more negative repercussions for organizations as more countries or states are putting in user privacy regulations in place, which means that there is potentially like larger financial repercussions if organizations do have these attacks occurring.
And really quickly, and then maybe you guys get in a little bit more technical after, but from a business perspective and a societal perspective, are there some industry that are more prone to be attacked? Like, just connected with both conversation we had, like, you know, entertainment industry, tickets for concerts or airline. It's kind of like, okay, that's the breeding ground for these. These, it, my head is probably very generic in term of, if he's on the client side, does it mean that everybody can steal something that is valuable?
Yes, really pretty much every industry is a target to be hit. When we're thinking about the three different types of data that these attackers are going after, we could think that the most valuable data is the credit card information. Then the second most valuable data is they want to get login credentials so that they can then steal whatever assets are in there. Maybe the credit card information is stored there. And then the third one, we call it profile building. And that's really any other sensitive information that they might be trying to steal. Let's say in the US, there's social security numbers, and that is needed when you're trying to apply for a loan. So if a malicious actor is trying to apply for a loan, they might want to not only steal the person's name and address, but also the social security number, and then they can apply for a fraudulent loan in that person's name. So really any organization, any industry where this type of sensitive data can be found, which is the majority of industries, it means that they could have valuable data that attackers might want to then end up wanting to attack them.
And what's the impact? I mean, there's the individual that's compromised. If they reuse the same login stuff, it could be reused. Bank details, of course, give you access to the bank information, the bank account presumably as well, which I suspect, and correct me if I'm wrong, that there's probably an entity that does this initial extraction and then they sell this off and somebody else uses it. Do we have any updates on kind of that life cycle of the extraction, sale, use, and the impact? Because the extraction seems to be taking a long time, low and slow. Do you see that changing the cycle of the use of that data as well?
Not so much. Really, you can think about, the data that they're stealing here, even though it might be one at a time. Let's say if they're attacking a very large organization that has hundreds or thousands of users that are going to the client side every day, that's still a nice chunk of sensitive data that they can get every day and can continue to sell it. Now, just like with server-side attacks, this is oftentimes like the beginning of a fraud assembly line occurring, right? They take the data, let's say it might be credit cards or login credentials. They can sell it on the dark web or use it themselves, and then they can use that data to then conduct whatever other fraudulent activities they might want to do. So that's really why it's so important to be able to stop these types of attacks at the very beginning, because by stopping them at the beginning, you're also reducing the likelihood that other types of attacks further down in the fraud assembly line are likely to occur on your application as well.
I love that visual, the assembly line. I'm sure the criminals like it even more than me, but you mentioned targeting an organization, and I want to maybe look at that a little bit, because I know like phishing attacks often are just spray and pray. Whatever we pick up, we're happy to get. But use the word targeted here. So is it always targeted, or is there just a general, wherever we find a vulnerable JavaScript, we're going to exploit it, and it's not targeted in any organization? Is it similar in that sense, or what do you see?
I would say that it could oftentimes be a spray and pray attack. Just in the same way that I'm looking for vulnerabilities on the server side, if I find vulnerabilities in the client side for any kind of website that has a decent amount of users going to it, as an attacker, once again, I want to go towards the path of least resistance. Even if this website might not end up having as much users as a larger website, if I can get any valuable data from them, that's still a win in my book. Now, one way that we haven't really discussed how these attacks are occurring is we talked about the first-party JavaScript and the third-party JavaScript. When you're thinking of the third-party JavaScript, you should also think about the supply chain. That's really what the third-party JavaScript is, right? It's all the supply chain of the different types of resources or JavaScript that are being brought into your client side. And what we often see attackers are doing is they actually want to compromise the third-party JavaScript that's being used by many different types of organizations. Because if I can compromise one organization that's a third-party JavaScript that's being used by 100 different websites, I only have to do the work once, but I get the data from all of those 100 different organizations' end users' data. So we've definitely seen a lot of attacks happening that way, and it really ends up increasing the scope of the end users that unfortunately end up having their data stolen. And that's really, by the way, one of the it really is one of the most like dangerous things about this attack, right? You not only need to protect your own proprietary JavaScript, but you also have to make sure that any JavaScript that you are bringing into your client side is secure. And that's extremely difficult because, like I said earlier, you don't actually have access to the code. And also most organizations wouldn't have the time to be able to go through all of the code for any third-party JavaScript that they're bringing in.
This isn't just a library. This is actual JavaScript code that's performing some function, right?
Exactly. Any JavaScript that you bring into a page gets full access to the data that's being entered into that page. So let's say for organizations where you have the pages where there is sensitive data, like you really want to limit the third-party JavaScript as much as you can that you add to that page, because any additional JavaScript that you're adding is just increasing the potential attack vector that could occur.
Yeah, and it's easy for most people to picture credit card data, driver's license, and that kind of information. But guess what? Board apps are managed through the web. So board members are reading and submitting information and logging in and getting access to data. Sales portals, sales CRM systems are often web interfaced with sales data going in there, customer data going in there. So it's not just transaction banking stuff. There's a wide range of things here.
So you're all depressing me a little bit, Bill. What can we do about it, right? I mean, it's hard to find it, hang in there. If it gets in one place, in one script, it's all over the places as long as you use that particular script. Where are we standing here? What can a business do to avoid this? What is Imperva doing to help detect and fight this?
Yeah. So give me hope. I will work on that. Well, so hopefully one thing that is going to make you hopeful is that because this has become such a large concern, that the PCI DSS Council have actually put new requirements in place to force organizations that are processing payment information to have protection against this. So for anyone who's not familiar with PCI DSS, it's really just like a security standard that any organization that is processing payment information, whether it's, you know, like physical credit cards that are being swiped, or if there's any payment information that is being processed online, they have to adhere to these requirements. Otherwise, the payment providers, you know, like the Visas or the Chases of the world, could say that we are not going to want to work with your organization. And they could also have fines for organizations that don't meet the PCI compliance. So recently, PCI launched the new version of their requirements. It's PCI 4.0. And in this, they not only have many new requirements and suggestions that organizations need to adhere to, but they've added two specific requirements that are specifically related to protecting organizations and their client side from these JavaScript attacks. The actual numbers is 6.4.3 and 11.6.1. Those numbers have been in my head for months already. And pretty much what those are doing is that anyone who does have to adhere to PCI, they need to make sure that they have full visibility to all the JavaScript and the other resources that are executing on their client side. And then they also need to make sure that they have alerting in place. They need to make sure they have, let's say, written justification for why is this JavaScript living on your client side. And they also need to have a tamper-proof mechanism in place that's going to alert them if anything new is found. These new requirements, even though they're already been added to the handbook, they only become live as official requirements in March of 2025. So actually, it's March right now when we're recording this. And so there's actually exactly one more year that organizations have in order for them to put protection in place, put processes or whatever software they need to have in place so that in 1 year when they are meeting with their auditors and ensuring that they meet the PCI requirements, they can prove that they also adhere to these two new requirements that have been added to protect against Magecart attacks.
So you mentioned visibility, you mentioned alerting, which I'll tie in monitoring there. Mm-hmm. What else is involved? Because I think there's like obviously building and deploying to have a resilient system from the beginning. Maybe that's the visibility part. Tell me what Imperva delivers and where in the development, delivery, monitoring, response kind of slice that you sit to help cover some of these things.
Definitely. So first of all, Imperva has an extremely robust WAF that really every organization needs to have, not only from security perspective, but also from PCI perspective. So that's already a great way that you're able to protect from a lot of different client-side attacks, but not from Magecart attacks. And the reason for that is because, like we said, the third-party JavaScript, it's not coming from the origin, so it's not going to go through the WAF. And that's why Imperva launched a new product a couple of years ago called Client-Side Protection. We're very original with our name. We're just focusing on the fact that, hey, client-side attacks are becoming a lot more prevalent. Let's provide people with an easy way to start getting the visibility into what is executing on their client side and providing them with a way to either allow or to block whatever they want or don't want to continue executing. Then once the new PCI requirements came out, we've been doing a lot of work so that the product not only provides customers with all the security value that they need, but also is going to streamline their compliance process when they are working with their PCI auditors to prove that they are compliant. So first and foremost, we already talked about the visibility. We try to make getting the visibility as easy as possible for customers. So you literally have to click one button to onboard your website to client-side protection and start getting the visibility. We're using technology called content security policy headers. Sean, you might be familiar with them. They're, you know, it's really technology that's built into browsers. It's supported by all major browsers, and it allows us to provide our customers with the visibility, really build out the profile of everything that's in their client side as real users are interacting with their application. As they click around, we get reports about that, and that's what we use to start bringing that visibility. The next step is we provide customers with a lot of different types of insights about the different resources and JavaScript that is discovered. Because we know that just because I get a list of all of these things, how am I supposed to know what is it doing? Is it supposed to be here? So we provide with a lot of different types of insights. Let's say, when was this domain registered? What is it trying to transfer? You know, is it trying to transfer images? Is it trying to transfer data? Is it interacting with any other scripts? You know, like, let's say, is this like a third party script? Is this a fourth party script, right? This is going back to the supply chain where the train just continues to grow, and you have to make sure that you get the visibility to all of them. The third thing is, of course, the enforcement piece. So with client-side protection, customers are able to either choose to work with a security, with a positive security model or a negative security model. So with the positive security model, right, they can create an allow list. They can say, these are all the different resources and JavaScript that I want to allow. And then everything else is going to be automatically blocked. But we know that that can be a little difficult to compile. And that's why we also have added the negative security model functionality into the product. We call it the instant block functionality. And the great thing about that is, as soon as you see something that you don't want to have executing on your client side, once again, one click, and that is right away going to be blocked. And it's no longer going to be executing on your end user's client side. Really the last piece, because we have been talking about PCI a lot, we not only bring you the visibility, the insights, and the enforcement mechanisms that you need as security practitioners, but also you have a lot of the visibility and the views that are going to allow you to very easily understand what you need to do to maintain the PCI compliance, and also providing you with the different views or reports that is going to make it easier for you to prove compliance once you're actually in that audit. Because we know audits are no fun. We're just trying to make it as easy as possible for you when you are doing them.
So I want to talk to you about your job now in the context of this, because looking at threats, looking at building products that protect against those is one thing, but now we're talking about compliance and auditing, which is reporting as well. And so when you're interacting with prospects and customers and you're trying to define what this product needs to contain, how do you What do some of those conversations sound like with customers to say, this is the most important, here's how I need to figure it out? Because you're talking to compliance and auditors, not just app dev and security teams, right? So how do those conversations sound when you're having them?
Yeah, so I will say, building out this product, some of those conversations have been very interesting because these requirements are so new that many organizations and even auditors themselves said that they don't fully know yet how they're actually going to end up wanting to deal with these requirements once the requirements go fully live, which as a product manager trying to understand what features you need to build, that makes my job a lot more difficult. I mean, really, we started out by talking with as many different auditors as we could. But like I mentioned, because these requirements are quite new, you know, some of them or a lot of them really haven't had these requirements actually live in the field yet, right? It's just reading this language, which, you know, the PC, any kind of compliance language is always, you know, legalese. It's always kind of difficult to understand exactly what they're trying to say. From there, we got together with not only the usual customers that we're working with, which is the security practitioners, but also having them bring in their PCI auditors or anyone from their own organization that is in charge of making sure their organization is compliant with PCI. And honestly, it's been a real partnership working together, myself, engineers, and our customers to figure out what is PCI actually trying to get with these requirements, and trying to understand what is the best way that you can not only make sure that you comply with these new requirements, but also how can an organization actually operationalize these new requirements? So, yeah, I mean, honestly, I think dealing with this compliance piece has been a very interesting and unusual challenge that I haven't had to deal with before, even working in the security space, which is already a very crazy space to be in.
I love it. I love it. What do you think, Marco?
I'm going to be very suspicious about every website I'm going to go now. And but at the same time, for once, I was going to make a joke at the beginning where you describe what this client-side attack is like, for once, we cannot point the finger to the user and say it's the user fault for clicking here, for doing, I mean, they're really like just victim in this case. So I can see how the regulation had to kind of step in heavily, because it's something that, I don't know, it's like giving a card to someone and say it's safe and secure, don't worry, this comes straight from the manufacturer, and all of a sudden there is a bug in there and you don't want to deal with that. So I've learned a lot. I know, Sean, you love this kind of things, and
I do
too. I see that you were really going at it, so I'm just I've learned a lot.
I always have one more question.
Go for it.
Because you use the word operationalize, which is my favorite word. So you said one button you add your site. So tell me how organizations deploy what you offer and kind of that onboarding. What's that one button look like?
Yeah. You know, for your website that's already being protected by Imperva's WAF, you don't actually need to deploy any code, make any changes to your application. You literally click that one button, and right away we start injecting that content security policy report only header and start building out that visibility for you. So really getting that visibility, there's no excuse. We really tried to make it as easy as possible for you, and also removing any constraints that the application development teams might want to put in, where if you do need to ask them to deploy something, you might have some back and forth on that. This is something that the security teams can do completely by themselves, and it's really bringing the power back to them to be able to start getting that visibility, and operationalizing the authorizing and the blocking of what's living on the client side.
Nice. Nice. Well, with so many, I mean, countless websites, of course, and then exponentially as many and end user clients connecting to it all the time, it could be super difficult to get that control or visibility. Well, this has been fantastic. I don't know. Is there anything else you want to share in terms of future? I mean, PCI DSS-4 is current, but future, right? That's still in play. But any other insights you want to share for what might be coming?
Let's see. Really, I mean, for anyone who's working on the security side, really just make sure that your organization is looking right now at getting tools in place to start getting that visibility for you, and start really having a robust process working with your marketing or development teams, and ensuring that, of course, from the development side, you have a robust security process in place, making sure that the security teams are vetting out anything that they are trying to pull in, especially because we said that the third-party JavaScript that's being pulled in are a very good target. I would say that if there are any individuals that are listening in, have good online security sense. If a website looks sketchy, maybe don't enter in your information into that. Or, there are online, there's ways where you can have like a temporary credit card number created for you, that then that credit card can only be used on that specific website that you set. That's a really great way that you can protect your credit card number by using these temporary ones. And I think that, like I mentioned, we as people on the web, we really need to band together enforce, ensure that all the organizations where we're using their tools online, they are putting in these protections in place. So let's say if an organization does end up having a breach, like we've seen their customers getting together and having a lawsuit together, right, against that organization. And that's just like one way that as individuals, we can protect ourselves in this online world and insist that the companies provide us with a safe environment that we can play around with. So that's really my call out for both us as individuals and then also for organizations and the security practitioners that are working on protecting the client side.
I love how you use people of the web. I'm gonna take it, and if you don't mind, I'll use it again in other context.
But yes, but I want royalties, please.
That's okay. Right. I will copyright it with you together. No, it makes sense because I mean, think in society, people of the web is like all I always say is like you can't distinguish digital versus analog life anymore. We are all people of the web. We're all business of the web. And to reconnect to how I started when I asked you to explain me as a business person, what is this client-side security? I mean, after this conversation, I'm definitely sold on, you got my budget, that's for sure.
Yes.
And I'll go back to the beginning because I started with, Marco, are you looking over your shoulder? And I think what we're understanding is it's the responsibility of organizations looking over our shoulder for us, yeah. Right? They have the knowledge. It's at their fingertips with one button to understand what's going on there and to protect us. So hopefully they do. And for all WAF customers, turn that on. If you're not a WAF customer yet, please do become one and protect my bank account, please. I don't care about Marcos, but mine, I definitely want to.
There's nothing in there, so I got to.
There you go. There's that too. Well, Lynn, it's been fantastic chatting with you and learning more about this and knowing that you have a solution to the problem. And a lot of times a problem for organizations is compliance, right? And so a solution to that problem for them as well in connection to this, which is super helpful for many, I'm sure. So thank you for the chat, Marco, good stuff. And we'll see everybody on another brand story. Thanks to our friends at Imperva for bringing these stories to us. And we'll see you on the next one.
Yeah, and talking about EasyButton, there'll be a link to connect with Imperva and with Lynn, if she wants to share that. And just one button, just click
it. Just one, perfect.
And by the way, Imperva just released a really great report about client-side attacks, really the threat around them. If you're interested in learning more about the attack vector and how you can protect yourself, we will also link to that. It's a really great resource to give you like a high level overview into this new type of attack that you need to protect from.
Perfect.
That's it. Goodbye, everybody. Stay tuned for the next story with Imperva. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Insights, solutions, and networking all come together at RSA Conference. Join a global cybersecurity community at rsaconference.com/ITSPMAG24.
We hope you enjoyed this episode and that you will come back for more brand stories on ITSP Magazine. If you want to share your company's brand story, go to itspmagazine.com and explore our advertising options to learn more. Remember to share this podcast with your friends, family, and colleagues, and stay tuned for more brand stories as we continue our journey toward redefining cybersecurity, technology, and society.